listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Sudan and South Sudan head to the negotiating table. Will this finally clear up old business? Stop that carp. Canada says it'll spend millions on keeping its lakes free of fishy Asian invaders. And the author Kim Toy will tell us about her journey from being a lawyer to a writer via the professions of translator, interpreter, restaurateur and food commentator.
My first motivation for the book was really just to play with words. It was such a privilege for me just to be in front of a screen and look at words. You know, I can spend hours just to try to understand one word at a time.
And we'll have some great music too. So all that's to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Seven Western governments have expelled Syrian diplomats from their capitals today in a coordinated action against President Bashar al-Assad's government, spurred by revulsion over the killing of more than 100 civilians in a Syrian town. The British Foreign Minister, William Hague, said the expulsions aimed to tell Mr. Assad and his ruling elite that time was running out for them to comply with the peace plan, but he stressed that the expulsions would not be the only tactics against the Assad regime. UN Arab League peace envoy Kofi Annan has said he believes Syria to be at a tipping point, having told President Assad that the peace plan was not working.
I shared with President Assad my assessment that the six-point plan is not being implemented as it must. We are at a tipping point. The Syrian people do not want a future, their future to be one of bloodshed and division. Yet the killings continue and the abuses are still with us today.
The Muslim Brotherhood candidate in Egypt's presidential election runoff, Mohamed Morsi, has spoken out strongly against the arson attack on the headquarters of his opponent, Ahmed Shafiq, on Monday. Mr. Morsi has been seeking to broaden his appeal following an election result that's polarized the nation and led to even more violence. The Brotherhood has denied any role in the arson attack. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has today laid a wreath to honour UN peacekeepers who died in the line of duty. Speaking after a period of silence, Mr. Ban said there was much adversity faced by UN peacekeepers, but that civilians deserved peace and the sustainable rule of law.
We must do everything possible to get justice for the victims. At the same time, we can never retreat. In the face of mob violence, landmines and ambushes, we stay for the civilians who want and deserve peace.
There are currently 17 UN peacekeeping operations taking place around the world. An earthquake has killed at least 15 people in northern Italy, damaging buildings and spreading fear among thousands of residents who had been living in tents since a similar tremor 9 days ago. Officials said 200 people had been injured and seven were missing, trapped under the rubble of houses and warehouses in the Emilia-Romagna region. South Sudan has accused Sudan of launching fresh bombing raids on its territory today, casting a shadow over the resumption of talks to avoid a collapse into all-out war between the two African oil-producing neighbours. The reports, which could not be confirmed independently, came hours before the neighbours sat down to their first direct negotiations since a series of clashes broke out along their disputed border in April. A convoy of self-driven cars has completed a 200-kilometre journey on a Spanish motorway in the first public test of such vehicles. The cars were wirelessly linked to each other and mimicked a lead vehicle driven by a professional driver. The so-called road train has been developed by Volvo. The firm is confident that they'll be widely available in future. A spokesman said the project aimed to herald a new age of relaxed driving. Those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, James. And James will be back in a little under a half an hour to bring us the latest news headlines. You're listening to Midori House and the time is just coming up to 5 minutes past the hour.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
This is Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And our top story today concerns Sudan and South Sudan, who have both returned to the negotiating table. It'll be the first time the two countries have held talks since last month's fighting at their border threatened to drag the situation back to full-out war. But even as the announcement was made, the South Sudanese accused their neighbours of firing shells at them. Khartoum has dismissed the claims. Well, to bring us up to date and assess the situation, I'm pleased to say I'm joined by Tristan McConnell, the senior Africa correspondent for Global Post and also a regular Monocle contributor. Very warm welcome to Midori House, Tristan. We cannot underestimate the importance of these talks, can we?
No, absolutely not. I mean, we've seen a number of rounds of talks over many years to try and resolve these issues that are still outstanding. They stalled most recently about a month ago when fighting broke out over an oil field called Heglig, which is North Sudan's most important oil field. And that really showed us what's at stake here, because for a few days back in April, the two countries did go to war. I mean, there's a lot of talk about whether the kind of tit-for-tat fighting and the bombing that we heard about even just this morning, whether it will, you know, grow into an all-out war, as it were. But, you know, in April, that really did happen. We had two armies facing off against each other and killing hundreds of soldiers on either side. And in that case, it didn't spread. Both sides did eventually pull back under huge international pressure. But that really indicates to us how close to war these two sides are. And the only way to resolve the issues is through these discussions that are being held in Addis Ababa.
You were talking there about international pressure, and I imagine you're referring to threats from United Nations sanctions and also an order to halt hostilities, which both parties signed up to. What's brought them to the table at this time now?
Well, international pressure certainly plays its part. Although, you know, threats of sanctions and so on have, they get more traction in the south than they do in the north. I mean, Khartoum has a long history of ignoring international pressure, wherever it may come from, whether, you know, sanctions from the US or the EU or pressure from the UN or even the ICC, whereas the South is much more susceptible to diplomatic pressure. And that's really what helped bring them out of Heglig oil field last month and end that fight. But in this particular case, I mean, we've got the African Union obviously hosting it, and the African Union is putting a lot of pressure on both sides. But we mustn't discount the importance of economic factors at the moment, because as part of this long-standing and ongoing dispute, in January the South, which controls most of the oil fields, basically stopped production, which means both North and South are now seeing their economies being strangled because they both rely very heavily on oil, and they can't really afford to continue fighting. So I think that the sort of domestic economic pressures are also contributing to bringing the two parties back to the negotiating table at this particular moment.
Khartoum has said that it is only security that it's prepared to talk about at these talks. Do you think we'll ever get to the long-term problems involving the oil issue?
That's a good question. Security obviously has to come first, but in a sense, you know, security is it's a very big umbrella under which you can talk about a lot of different issues. For example, you know, this area called Abyei, which people might have heard about, is a disputed territory. Now, that gets to kind of the crux of the dispute here. It's over who actually owns certain pieces of territory, and certain pieces of territory are oil producing, or they are, you know, inhabited by communities who owe their allegiance to the north or south. And you can look at that through the prism of security, but what you're really talking about are these broader issues. Whether oil will actually be on the agenda, I mean, it's hard to believe it won't be. I mean, yeah, security comes first. You know, you can't be fighting a war with your neighbor. But, you know, both North and South are essentially killing themselves through this oil stoppage that is underway at the moment. And they simply can't afford to continue like this for much longer.
They are absolutely dependent on each other, aren't they? Because when the countries split, the South took, 75% of the former country's oil production, but it needed the North to get the oil out.
Yeah, that's exactly the issue. And that's been a big kind of disappointment, really, to a lot of the observers of the relations between the two Sudans over the last few years since, since the 2005 peace agreement, which ended, you know, decades of civil war between the two sides. And there was this kind of belief that the fact that the South produced the oil, but the pipelines all ran north, so they were, you know, this belief that that would bind the two together. But instead, the oil has turned out to be, you know, a very divisive factor. And that reached its sort of nadir, really, in January, with the South deciding to just shut off the oil altogether. And that was in response to, you know, stalemated discussions over how much the South should be paying the North in transit fees for sending its oil through its pipelines. I mean, all this kind of arcane stuff. But that is what has led directly to, you know, the growing fear of conflict between the two sides.
You mentioned a moment ago the Abyei region. Sudan stormed it last year, but what is the significance of it now within these talks?
Well, it has huge symbolic significance, really. I mean, years ago, it was an important oil-producing area, and so there was an economic significance to it. But there was a boundary commission decided in 2005 to sort of hive off some of the most important oil fields that were in Abyei. So Abyei now doesn't produce much oil, so it's not really about that. It's about grazing land and farming land, which sounds slightly ridiculous, but you know, you've got people living there throughout the year who are essentially southerners. They're newer people. And you've got nomads who pass through that area during the rainy season for the grazing lands, and they owe their allegiance to the north. And both sides, both Khartoum and Juba, feel like they owe something to the people living there. So that's what it really comes down to. This Abyei is symbolically very important, and it also kind of represents the broader discussion that was never resolved during the peace agreement in 2005, which is, you know, where is the border? Which side of the border community you live on? Who is control of territory and where? And these incredibly fundamental things just weren't dealt with by either by Sudan, South Sudan, or the international community in the years between the 2005 peace deal and the South independence last July.
There's also the issue of all the refugees who fled after this storming last year, isn't there? What's happened to them and what can happen to them now?
Well, I suppose there's a chance they might return home. I mean, I saw Khartoum has announced that they've withdrawn from Abyei just a couple of hours ago. Haven't seen any independent verification of that, and they do have a tendency to, you know, announce things that perhaps they haven't quite done yet. But if the North does indeed pull its forces out of Abyei, then there is already an Ethiopian peacekeeping force there. And it would be theoretically possible for the Southerners to move back into their homes. Whether they'd be willing to do so is quite another question. But for the moment, they're still, you know, a year later, living in, you know, temporary camps underneath trees south of Abyei.
Tristan, while I've got you on the line, there was an article that you wrote on Global Post in the last couple of days, which is a response to an academic piece on Africa, in which the author claims that coverage of Africa is inaccurate, full of stereotypes, and that editorial decisions are the result of lazy fixes and NGOs driving agendas. Obviously, you responded to this, and you being a senior Africa correspondent. What's your response to allegations that journalism is not doing its best in Africa?
Well, her piece, it wasn't an academic piece. It was a piece by an academic. It was an opinion article which basically said that we were all sloppy and rubbish at our jobs. And I found that obviously quite offensive as a journalist who's lived and worked in Africa for quite a number of years now. But my main response is that, we live here, a lot of us foreign correspondents, and we know the areas we write about or report on fairly well. And that knowledge that we have is built up through, you know, kind of lived experience and on-the-ground experience. And, you know, academics such as the writer of this piece, who's at a university in Atlanta, you know, they spend a lot of time with their noses in books. And I guess it comes down to a question of what kind of knowledge you value, whether you value knowledge that comes from, you know, actual experiences or whether it comes from reading. And, you know, that was kind of the gist of my thing. I mean, you know, she did have some valid points, of course, in her piece, and that is that, you know, coverage of Africa could be better, of course. We could always do better. And there could be more African voices within that coverage in terms of, you know, African journalists working for international media outlets. But, you know, to lay the blame for what she sees as poor coverage on the journalists themselves and not look at perhaps, you know, the market is you know, I think a bit of a fault in her argument. You know, she sort of advocated having a reporter in every single country in Africa, which would be 54, which is just untenable in the current kind of economic climate with newspaper sales falling and all the rest of it. So her solutions, I didn't think, were particularly realistic. But, you know, of course, we could all be better and we all strive to be better and we would love to see more coverage of Africa. And, you know, I'm very glad that I'm talking to you on Midori House about Sudan at the top of your news. I think that's wonderful. But there's too little of that. And, you know, I think she and I would both agree that it would be great to see more attention paid to Africa and to African stories.
I think your criticism was more of the, not necessarily bad journalism, but bad journalism as perhaps a result of bad resources that are used to cover the continent. You have a space of 11 million square miles. Like you say, you have 54 countries, but you also have news outlets which are withdrawing reporters left, right and centre from every continent, not just Africa. And also you talk about parachuting reporters in. I think that is a symptom of every single newsroom of the world nowadays. What marks Africa out so differently?
Well, it is a large unreported space, you know. It's often very low on the international news agenda. You know, it doesn't get the kind of play that, you know, the Middle East gets or whatever because, you know, to a lot of people, it doesn't really have these strategic significances, you know. Yes, there's increasing resource production, and that means that, you know, Washington's interested because there's oil here or what have you. But it generally is not seen as of strategic value, and therefore, you know, it tends to slide down to the bottom of the agenda and end up just being stories about, you know, miserable things happening to people in faraway places. And of course, there's a lot more to say than that. So I think Africa has been sort of neglected by news organizations and marginalized and what have you. But, you know, yes, you're absolutely right. We all face the same challenges at the moment, and we all parachute into places. But, I mean, there's nothing wrong with parachuting into a place if you do it on a fairly regular basis, as I do with the countries that I cover. I mean, yeah, I don't live in Sudan, but I go there, you know, every couple of months, and I build up contacts that way, build up knowledge that way. And, you know, I think it's not ideal, but it's a pretty decent solution to the you know, the strictures within which we all have to operate.
Tristan, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. That was the Monocle contributor, Tristan McConnell. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time is creeping up to 18 minutes past the hour. We'll be back in a moment with some music.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
All next week on Monocle 24, we'll be bringing you a special series of daily programmes dedicated to the world of current affairs. A mix of big-name interviews, reports from around the world, and in-studio analysis, the Foreign Desk will cover all the big stories, from Afghanistan to Greece, the Arab Spring to the US elections. That's the Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, all next week at 7 a.m. London time on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. In a moment, we will be carping on about fish in Canada. Please excuse a pun. Let's have some music, though, first. This is Rainbow Girl by Jana Factory. And that was Denmark's Jana Factory, who did a rather splendid session here at Midori House in January. If you rummage around our time shift player on the Monocle 24 website, you'll be able to trawl back to the Culture Show around about that time, and you'll be able to catch that session. It's 23 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Now, not many countries have $17.5 million just sitting around waiting to be spent on fish. Canada, however, is just about to do just that. Or rather, it's about to spend $17.5 million Canadian dollars on stopping the Asian carp from invading its lakes. And the Asian carp is, by all accounts, an invasive sort. It's threatening to swim over the border from the United States. Well, to tell us more, we're joined now by John Nevin, the Public Information Officer at the Great Lakes Regional Office of the International Joint Commission in Canada. A very warm welcome to Midori House, John. Just explain to us the nature of this threat.
The nature of the threat is that the Asian carp, not being native to the Great Lakes, could potentially, if it does enter the lakes, become the main part of the biomass in the system. For example, if it were to make it into the lakes, it grows so quickly and eats so much food, it would use up the food supply of other fish and simply drive them out of existence. And many studies have shown so far that if the Asian carp, which grow to as much as 100 pounds and produce millions of eggs each year, could potentially devastate a $7 billion sport and commercial fishery in the Great Lakes.
That is a very big fish, by all accounts. So how will they spend this money to stop these carp from coming over?
Well, they're going to spend it in several different ways. The key element of $17.5 million is prevention, is trying to identify exactly where the carp could enter the lakes and doing the research that's needed to make sure that we can keep them out. A key aspect of that, of course, is on the U.S. side in the Chicago area, where there are canals that are used for commerce and trade, there needs to be a system developed in which those waterways are separated from the Great Lakes and so that the carp can't enter the Great Lakes that way.
I was about to say, how do you stop a carp from swimming to its destination? I mean, not to sound too flippant about it, gentle persuasion and passport control isn't really going to work here, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, although in a strange way, passport control has worked pretty well so far, in that there have been some shady operators who have tried to ship live Asian carp on trucks across the bridge from Detroit to Windsor, in Ontario, and they have been stopped by the border authorities there. I think in the neighborhood of several tons of fish over the last couple of months. So that actually the border control folks have done a good job in that aspect. But when they're swimming in the waters, yes, you're right, it is very difficult. One thing that's in place right now in one of the canals near Chicago is an electric barrier. They shoot about a volt or two of current into that water, and the fish swim up to it, feel the discomfort, and they turn around. So that's one way it could be done. There's a lot of research going on with various acoustic methods, sound barriers, bubble barriers. So some of this funding will go to ways to try to figure out how to create barriers for the fish. Another key element, and this is what's really important to our commission, because the International Joint Commission was created by a treaty between England and the U.S. On behalf of Canada over 100 years ago, and our sole mission is to help the two countries work together to share and protect the Great Lakes. And we're very concerned about the prevention aspect, but in addition to that, is what will we do if we did find a carp, say in the waterway by Detroit in the Detroit River? What would you do? Who would be in charge? You have a state government, you have a provincial government, you have city governments, you have county governments, you have conservation authorities, you have all sorts of levels of bureaucracy, of the Coast Guard and the Department of Environmental Quality. Who would actually be in charge of finding out if there are more fish? How would they clean up the problem? We have protocols in place for chemical spills or an oil spill. Everybody knows what to do, and those agencies fall into place, and oil spills or chemical spills are dealt with. We have no such system in place for detection of an invasive species and eradication of it. So that's one of the ways this money will be used.
I must confess, I'm listening to you there talking about putting a little electrified barrier. I think that's a very bold move in a large body of water, but we'll wish you the best of luck with that one. You're talking about cooperation between the United States and Canada. The Obama administration says it spent more than, $100 million on trying to stop the lakes being invaded from, what is it, silver and big head carp. is what $17.5 million Canadian dollars going to be enough to stop the Asian carp?
Well, it's all for the same purpose, and what's really important about the $17.5 million is that it shows commitment, a very strong and substantial commitment on the part of Canada to be a full partner with the U.S. in trying to address the problem. And it also recognizes the fact that Chicago vector is not the only one, and there are potentially places where, let's say, in Ontario, if a person wanted to simply just introduce carp, a live carp to the lake. So we want to make sure that stops as well.
You mentioned a moment ago the export of carp. Tell me why these people are doing that.
It's a very lucrative business because you've got large populations of people who've moved here from Asian countries where the Asian carp is a very prized source of protein. And it's traditionally bought live. It's not acceptable to eat it frozen or in a form that's not alive. You have to buy it at the store live and then kill it and eat it. And so that's the traditional method of eating it. And so it's a very lucrative business for people to try to ship it live and deliver it live to their customers. But that's now illegal in both countries.
And finally, it's a question I should have asked you a moment ago. Why is it called an Asian carp?
Well, these are carp that are native to China and to other countries in that part of the world. And while European carp that you might find in a pond in England are also introduced species here, they're not a problem. They've not multiplied. They've not caused a problem. But it's these Asian carp species that are related to the carp that you might find in England, but just to grow much more quickly are just a really big problem. Where they have been introduced.
John, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. That was John Levin, Public Information Officer at the Great Lakes Regional Office of the International Joint Commission in Canada. It's 1:30 the hour here on Monocle 24. In the next half hour, we'll be heading to Argentina to check in with our man in Buenos Aires, and we'll also talk about startups in New York City. So lots more to pack into the next 30 minutes. Before that, let's get the latest news headlines from James.
Seven Western governments have expelled Syrian diplomats from their capitals today in a coordinated action against President Bashar al-Assad's government, spurred by revulsion over the killing of more than 100 civilians in a Syrian town. The British Foreign Minister William Hague said the expulsions aimed to tell Mr. Assad and his ruling elite that time was running out for them to comply with the peace plan. The UN Arab Peace Envoy Kofi Annan has said he believes Syria to be at a tipping point, having told President Assad that the peace plan was not working. The Muslim Brotherhood's candidate in Egypt's presidential election runoff, Mohamed Morsi, has spoken out strongly against the arson attack on the headquarters of his opponent, Ahmed Shafiq, on Monday. Mr. Morsi has been seeking to broaden his appeal following an election result that has polarised the nation and led to even more violence. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has today laid a wreath to honour UN peacekeepers who died in the line of duty. Speaking after a period of silence, Mr. Ban said there was much adversity faced by UN peacekeepers, but that civilians deserved peace and the sustainable rule of law. An earthquake has killed at least 15 people in northern Italy, damaging buildings and spreading fear among thousands of residents who've been living in tents since a similar tremor 9 days ago. Officials said 200 people had been injured and 7 were still missing. South Sudan has accused neighbouring Sudan of launching fresh bombing raids on its territory today, casting a shadow over the resumption of talks to avoid a collapse into all-out war between the African oil-producing neighbours. And a convoy of self-driven cars has completed a 200-kilometre journey on a Spanish motorway in the first public test of such vehicles. The cars were wirelessly linked to each other and mimicked a lead vehicle which was driven by a professional driver. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. And James will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news. It's 28 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And it is time now to find out what's caught the eye of one of Monocle's men or women from across the globe. And I'm pleased to say we're joined now by Monocle's Buenos Aires correspondent, Ed Stocker. Hello again, Ed. Welcome to Midori House. Tell us what's been catching your eye.
Hi, Emma. How are you?
Very well indeed. Thank you very much indeed. It's a lovely day in London. We're going to talk about the black market economy in dollars. Is that right?
That is correct. That's the word on everyone's lips at the moment. The news here is obsessed with how the dollar is doing. Basically, this is about the official dollar rate and the unofficial black market and how there's a growing disparity between the two. Basically, Argentina has been clamping down on the sale of dollars recently for people traveling abroad and just for people trying to access the dollar as currency within the country, which is causing this disparity between the two currencies, or the black market and the official one. The reason for this is basically in Argentina, people still like to change currency into dollars. They feel more secure having dollars than pesos. And it's still the case now that people actually hoard dollars. It's not rare to have people who have a box of dollars in their house, or instead of even putting it in the bank, they might actually have a safety deposit box with dollars. I guess this is partly to do with the economic crash in 2001. People are still, you know, don't have confidence in their own currency, and so they're obsessed with changing money into what they see as a stronger, safer, more secure currency.
There are some quite astonishing anecdotes, as you say, firstly about stuffing dollars under mattresses, but also people going down back alleys being offered dollars in a manner not dissimilar to being offered drugs. It's really quite astonishing.
Well, you do see that. If you go to the centre of town, there are lots of people hanging out sort of openly trading dollars, and you know, there's so many people who want to do it. And with the tighter controls, it's getting harder for Argentinians to actually access the official rate. So, but they're still prepared to pay a worse rate, as it were, from the unofficial, or what they call the blue market here. So it's a concern, I guess, and it shows that there seems to be, you know, money. There are periods of fluctuation within Argentina when money goes out the country with the whole YPF debacle. It shows, I think, you know, certain investors are getting jittery, and money's in dollars is leaving the country. I mean, again, it happened at the end of last year. People get jittery when certain things happen, and obviously for a certain section of society, what happened with the nationalisation of YPF makes investors or businessmen or a wealthy section of society slightly jittery.
You mentioned, Ed, that there are clampdowns by the government. What are they, and are they... And are there any realistically enforceable penalties associated with operating on the black market?
Well, it's not so much that they're penalising the black market. It's just they're making it harder to access dollars from the official market. It's basically because there's a large amount of tax evasion and undeclared income in Argentina. A lot of, as I said before, lots of people don't keep their money in bank accounts. So part of the clampdown is to try and improve the financial system, I guess, by getting people to declare incomes or having to provide more details in order to get access to dollars, so that AFIP, which is the tax office, can start to regulate the system more and have more of an idea of what's actually happening. Because Argentina, in a way, is a unique case, because there's such a lack of people using bank accounts and there's so much financial evasion, as it were. It makes it a very, I guess, cumbersome or difficult system to regulate.
But let's move on to something else that's been making the headlines in Argentina. That's the death of a football fan. What can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, Argentina, as you probably know, is a fanatical about football. And the Clausura, which is the two sections to the season, which, and this is the second one, which is about to come to a close. There's three games left. And at the weekend, yes, there was a death. I mean, it was actually between two factions from the same football team, which makes it sort of bizarre, really, the fact that it was infighting between supporters, you know, fighting for the same team. So there was a shooting. Someone was shot in the chest and later died. Football violence is a massive problem in Argentina. I think the UK has a reputation, but it's cleaned up its act massively. Whereas in Argentina, there's fans known as Barra Bravas, the hooligans, are involved in all sorts of dealings and intrigue, from drug trafficking to sort of political violence. So it continues to be a huge problem.
Is it a sort of a minority group of hooligans, as you describe them, who are violent and who go armed to football matches, or is there just a general malaise within Argentinian football supporters?
It's a small faction, but it's a powerful faction, I guess. I think because there's corruption or a lack of accountability within the whole system, as in, I think police officers are often involved with what's happening. It's been very hard for Argentinian football to clean up its act because I think there's so many different players who are involved in it. But of course, there is the lighter side to football. And there's a story about the American actor, Viggo Mortensen, who actually grew up in Argentina. I think his parents moved here when he was three, and he was based in Buenos Aires until he was about 11. And he became a massive fan of San Lorenzo, which is one of the teams in the first division that's in the relegation zone at the moment, so fighting to survive in the top tier. And he was, in Washington, watching at an airport, waiting to fly somewhere, and watching the game via his computer on the internet. And when San Lorenzo scored a vital goal, he got a bit overexcited and started jumping up between the baggage of all the different passengers waiting as well, which caused the American security guards to come over and ask him for his passport and ask him what he was doing. Then he had to explain he was actually just watching a football game and got a bit overexcited after a goal was scored. So he's a massive fan and wears his shirt everywhere, apparently, all over the States. He often turns up in the red and blue of his San Lorenzo.
That's a sight that I think we'll all look forward to seeing. Ed, thank you very much, as ever, for joining us. That was Monocle's correspondent in Buenos Aires. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking startups in New York City.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Well, it's Tuesday, which means it's time for a business chat. With a chap. It's not. It's going to be a chat with a lady, in fact. This week, we've been intrigued by the rising profile of New York as a destination for startups. What are its chances for creating an East Coast tech challenger to Silicon Valley? Well, to tell us more, we're joined on the line now by the small business editor for the New York Times and frequent Monocle contributor, Lauren Fellman. A very warm welcome, Lauren. Just tell us about this draw always that's been to Silicon Valley. Is this because Silicon Valley always offers so much more that the rest of the country just lags terribly behind?
I think a lot of it just simply has to do with success breeding success. That was the first place that community got started. It grew by leaps and bounds. There was tremendous success and all the reason in the world for like-minded people to gather nearby. More recently, there's been some success here, and you know, things are evolving similarly, although I don't think anybody here is really expecting New York City to be to supersede Silicon Valley.
When you mean that things are evolving, what's happening? What do you mean?
I think there's a lot more activity. I mean, to me, the most impressive thing is the fact that you have a few Silicon Valley venture capital offices opening locations in New York City, and that's a clear indication that they see potential here. The other thing that I find most interesting is there's been this huge wave of incubators and co-working spaces. There's one in particular called General Assembly that's here in Manhattan that's really impressive. They have beautiful space. They have a lot of people hanging out. They have high energy. They do a lot of educational stuff. They have big events. They have a big event space as part of what they offer. And they make things a little bit more economical for somebody who's trying to start a company. So that's just one of a bunch of those kinds of places that has opened of late. And I think they're creating a lot of the buzz that you're hearing.
You're talking a moment about funding and the fact that venture capital financing has been quite poor outside Silicon Valley. Who's now coming into New York and offering money?
You know, this is actually, I have to be honest with you, this is not the area that I cover most aggressively. The truth is, companies that are venture funded are a tiny percentage of startups in general, and they get too much attention, if anything, in my opinion. You know, in part, the truth is, taking venture capital money is probably the worst way to get a company off the ground, except for all the others. If there's anything an entrepreneur can do to avoid taking that money and losing that control, it's worth trying. So from where I sit as the small business editor, I'm not covering this area that aggressively. I know that there are several well-known Silicon Valley firms that have set up shop here. Fred Wilson is the best-known venture capitalist in New York. I don't really know. I follow that community closely, though, and I can't tell you which ones are making inroads here.
So, I mean, apologies for asking you, you know, slightly beyond your remit, but you were talking earlier about co-working spaces. What other things are being dangled? What other carrots are being dangled towards small entrepreneurs?
Well, in terms of what we're discussing here, and that's, you know, technology startups taking venture capital money, it's all about the money. And, you know, the entrepreneurs will go wherever the money is. Now, New York has been a tough place to get a company off the ground. It's expensive here. We have not to date had the kind of infrastructure, and really, I guess the most important aspect of that is employees. We do not have the engineers here that you can find so easily in Silicon Valley. And that has changed a little bit of late. So if you're asking me, you know, what are the factors in this slight change of course, I think that might be the biggest. I think traditionally in New York, people with those kinds of skills have gone into finance. Finance has had a hard time of late, as you may have heard, and some of those people have been looking for other opportunities. And I think it's made it a lot easier for a startup company to find the kind of talent they're looking for here.
So basically, the recession has effectively helped New York startups because they can go talent shopping on their doorstep. Is that right?
That's right. You know, there are always winners and losers in any situation. There are people who are going to, you know, in a bad economy, somebody's going to benefit because prices of something are going to be slightly cheaper, or things that weren't previously available are now going to be available. And that's exactly what's happened in this case.
What about the issue of franchises? Because there have always been reports that only California is any good at this.
Franchises for any kind of business?
In terms of for startups and yes, any kind of business.
That's not something I'm aware of. It's never been pointed out to me that California does that better than others. I think franchising is always a difficult decision. It again, it's like taking venture capital money in the sense that it's a way to grow, but it costs you control. And that trade-off is always going to be a difficult one. And it takes a very good manager to make it work. How do you impart your culture to essentially to someone else's business? It's a franchise. It's got your name on it, but someone else owns it. And that's a very tricky thing to do wherever you do it.
Lauren, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Lauren Feldman, the small business editor for the New York Times and frequent Monocle contributor. And I must correct myself earlier. Lauren is, of course, as is self-evidently, a gentleman. It is 22 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Time now for a little bit of music. This is Lisa Ekdahl and Nasta Dag. And that was a rather charming Lisa Ekdahl and Nasta Dag. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 10 minutes to the top of the hour, and we now turn to an author. Kim Toy worked as a seamstress, interpreter, lawyer and restaurateur before finding her true calling as a writer. Her first book, Rue, is a semi-autobiographical account of her extraordinary journey from her native Vietnam via a Malaysian refugee camp to Quebec. A little earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards spoke to Kim Toy, and he started by asking her how she'd classify her work. Could it be a novel, poetry, or even a memoir?
I don't think it's even a book. They're just words put together. And my first motivation for the book was really just to play with words. It was such a privilege for me just to, you know, to be in front of a screen and look at words. You know, I can spend hours just to try to understand one word at a time. And probably because French is not my language, so I have this insecurity that maybe I have not looked at the whole picture of the word, and so that was the first motivation. And after that, the story came as an exit story, I would say, because I had only 1 month. I didn't have time to go do any research, so that came very easily because I knew the story. I knew how I had the facts, and that's how it all started. So I don't know. I don't know what it is still today, 3 years later.
It's very much a story of a journey. And it sounds like your experience of creating the book was a similar journey, though much shorter scale. I wonder how important the idea of the journey is as a sort of an emblem for the story.
I think, you know, the Vietnamese, we really carry our ancestors just above our head. They're not behind us. They're just above us. And the Vietnamese say that we are the result of what our ancestors had done in their life for us. So if they were bad people, we will have a bad destiny. And if we are bad people, then we will give bad destiny to our descendants, right? So you have the responsibility to be good because of that. So the past is in the present and the future is also in the present. So it's all in one piece. So to me, it's not traveling from one point A to point B or from one job to another. It's just one on one string and one in one breath, actually. And at first, you see, now you have different chapters, different paragraphs in the book. But at first, it was just on one page, I would say. And it was the publisher who asked me if I could just break them up into smaller pieces. And when I started writing it every morning, you know, under the shower, I would say, oh, today I would like to talk about story A or write about story A. But when I sat down, I could never write story 8, because I would read again from the first line and then continue the flow of the text more than what I wanted to write about. So I don't know, is it a journey? Probably, but a journey guided by the sound of the words, you know, that carry me along more than the stories.
There's an interesting part here where you talk about, or the voice of the book talks about, I never leave a place with more than one suitcase. Mm. I take only books. Nothing else can become truly mine. And I thought that's quite interesting about exactly what you're talking about, that sense of just a moment.
Yes.
But also only books. And that struck me quite, I mean, it's quite interesting. Is there something sort of magical do you find about the book beyond any other sort of material possession almost?
Because when I was brought up with many books around me in a family who everyone read a lot. And when the communists came in, it was a big problem for us to own so many books. And 10 of the soldiers stay with us in the house to do the inventory of our possessions. And books were a big problem because they had to write down every single book that we own. And after that, to accuse us of being anti-patriotic and all of that. So I was very little then. I was maybe 8 or 9. So my parents said that asked the children to go and steal the most compromising books, you know, on politics, to burn them, because the only way for us to destroy the books was to burn. Every single time that we got in or out of the house, we were inspected. So at night, we would go up on the rooftop and burn the books. But very quickly, we got denounced because there was no electricity back then in Vietnam, not all the time. So at night, it was really, really dark. And you could imagine if all of a sudden in the middle of the neighborhood, there's a fire on top of a tower, then everybody would look at it. And so we got denounced very quickly. But I did participate in tearing the pages. Contrarily to what we think, books don't burn so well because there's no oxygen, right? So the children had to tear all the pages so the adults could burn the book. And I thought it was such a barbarian gesture, you know, to tear pages, the pages of a book. And when we arrived in Canada, we were so poor. Of course, we didn't have any money. And my mother and I, we made probably $2 a day. So we couldn't spend money on books. And we didn't know about, you know, libraries. In a country at war, if you lend a book, you never see it again, right? People don't come back. Maybe they die. Maybe, I don't know, something would happen. And so we didn't know about libraries, number one. And number two, I don't know, we just didn't have any money to go buy books. So to learn French, my mother forced us to do dictation of the ads, you know, newspapers ads that we got at home for free. And the first book that we bought was in 1982 when L'Amant of the Lover of Marguerite Duras came out. And my uncle, who's only 7 years older than me, and he stayed in the same house, and he spoke French way before we arrived. So he said, "We have to buy this book. This book seems to be really great." And it was $15. It was a huge amount, right? But so we went, and just to not waste any of the $15, he read it with me, sentence by sentence, to make sure that I understood everything. And then after that, dictation from page one to the last page. And the best way to learn a language is by heart. So I had to learn by heart, you know, the whole book. And it's so funny because I spoke like Marguerite Duras for the whole year, you know, exactly the same way. And so to me, books is something so precious, because otherwise in a house without books, I would feel, I don't know, empty. So, yeah, maybe that's why that's the only thing that I carry.
Just finally, Kim, I wondered, you talk about not really knowing exactly how to sort of define the book, if you like, in terms of the type of work that it is. I wonder what your aspirations for what a reader will take from reading this book? Will it be as a history or as a sort of an honest personal account? Do you have an ambition for what the reader will take?
Maybe a travel, a moment to be outside of the timeline, you know, that I will be able to just take them into that bubble, just with sensations, you know, that you don't need to think anymore, but just feel whatever that we were feeling or what I'm trying to convey as sensations, more than intellectual because I don't think so much, you know. So I just hope that I do give almost like an atmosphere, an ambience more than fact, and then you would understand, but because of the sensations more than an analysis of the facts. I hope, anyway.
Well, I think it's a job very well done. It's a lovely read. Thank you very much for coming to tell us all about it.
That's Kim Toy talking to our news editor, Tom Edwards, about her new book. That's all we have time for today. Our producer was Daniel Giacopelli, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Tomi Hammond. I'm Emma Nelson. Goodbye. Thank you for listening.